And
then you just moved on basically up from there.
Mm-hmm. Well, C63, I worked in and out of his office in Sacramento. And that was on issues, particularly those issues that had to do with the genius.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly other related to trade union jobs and so on. Because like what I did, we got with the other advocates as such. And we had real good working relationship, I did, with the others. And I did that for about a year before they called me to go on assignment in San Antonio. Yeah, in San Antonio. And I was in San Antonio on a special assignment, Kelly Air Force Base. I went there to process some discrimination cases. There's about 35 of them. But it really went down to 18 because the others were just peripheral kind of things. And I stayed there on that assignment. It was in connection with our organizing campaign there. I stayed there for a year, came back home, and my other assignments, of course, then was back into politics, but not in that kind of involvement, community service work and organizing. And since that time, of course, it's been pretty much the same kind of thing until this past, year or two, when a new vice president came in, and the assignments now made pretty cut and dry. You know, you are either that or you are this. Well, that's the way it appeals to me. And of course, mine presently is organizing. That's where I'm now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there may be some period that I've moved away for a short period of time, but my assignment is organizing. And that's where I'm now. That's a quick way of talking
about it. Yeah, well, let me backtrack. And I mean, a lot of this, I think I'd want to come back and get more details as I do more work on it.
Mm-hmm.
But let me backtrack and ask you a couple of things. First of all, the group of you who were at Lockheed, who then became involved in the committee, and also those who weren't involved, were most of the people living in South Central Los Angeles and going up by bus to Lockheed?
Not most of them. I would say that, I would say it could have been most, but only by small numbers. Some lived in Pasadena. Some lived in central area.
Mm-hmm.
Some lived out in the Watts area. Some lived, there were a few lived on the west side of town,
mm-hmm.
because I lived on the west side of town. And some lived in the valley, you know.
Mm. Now, let me ask you a couple of things. One of the things that I've had a terrible time trying to find out, and it's very interesting to me, that they tagged files and coded them, because every time I say, well, I want to find out how many, it's easier to figure out how many black workers there were, because I knew they had records on that. I wanted to know about the Hispanics, because there's very little information in the census. Oh, well, we didn't keep those sort of records during that period. We'd have no way of finding that out for you. So,
well, the company did. The company identified Hispanics, males, females. Blacks, male, female.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Up until the time at which union really laid down the law,
mm-hmm.
and they stopped that. Now, of course, it's done with the intent
mm-hmm.
of carrying out affirmative action.
Right.
There was no such thing at that time. And the only reason they used that was to know when a black was coming in, they're going and being demoted or transferred,
mm-hmm.
and he's enough, the guy didn't want him in the school. No, we don't need it, you know, this kind of thing.
Now, my sense, as I started going through things, was that the heaviest concentration of black workers in, well, for instance, at Lockheed, was at the plant on 7th in Santa Fe. Were you in touch with those people?
Yes. In fact, Clarence Gibson, the guy I was telling you about,
mm-hmm.
he was located over there. But he lived, he lived in Hollywood. And when, once he found out about me and what I was doing, he got in touch with me. And he would help me with some of the blacks who were over there. So they knew about what was going on. I worked always in the valley.
Mm.
And I worked at the old Vega plant, which was at that time next to Manasco,
mm-hmm.
on the San Fernando Road and Olive. Not Olive. Was it Olive? San Fernando Road and... I'm not sure. Well, I don't think
mm-hmm.
it was Olive. I don't think so. Then, of course, way later, I transferred to B1. And not stayed there at B1 until moved into the full-time job of Ben Strupp and then to this job.
But the committee itself was all the Burbank people rather than Maywood and Santa Fe and
Well, that time he didn't. Maywood plant wasn't there.
Mm.
See, Maywood plant came in later. And it might have been on a tail end. I think Maywood might have been, but we didn't have too much involved in Maywood plant. There might have been a few people that knew about it, but not too much. Mm. As I said, I don't think Maywood is coming to being.
Now, what about, can you tell me anything about Reginald Jones?
Sure. Reginald Jones was at the Maywood plant. Reggie found out about what I was doing, and he, too, got interested. But see, Reggie wasn't always in supervision, but they moved Reggie into supervision later. And that was because contacts that Reggie had, he knew somebody, I think Randall Irvin, who was at that time, I think, head of our industrial relations, the big guy.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Irvin had gone to school with, I think, Reggie. So he was made a supervisor, and he was made, I think, a supervisor over the utility workers or something like that. And these were mostly janitors and this kind of thing. But anyway, he was one of the first blacks in the salary, in fact, the only one that I know of. Then way later, see, Reggie left. And later, Reggie came back into personnel. And Reggie stayed in personnel, I guess, until he passed. Reggie handled equal employment opportunity before it was known as equal employment opportunity, and I guess it's called it, handled a discrimination complaints. And what else? Well, that's...
So this is almost right, because I've come across references to a minority training program under Reginald Jones.
Yeah, well, Reggie handled anything that had to do with minorities, particularly blacks.
Mm-hmm.
Reggie was involved. And Reggie had a great deal of respect from the company. But again, that was primarily because of the people that knew him and this kind of thing. Because Lockheed Management had very little insight into minority and minorities and minority areas, you know. So they had to reach out, and they usually reach out to the Urban League, which was about the closest thing to them you could think of, and they rather would stay in NAACP. But this is their only connection at the time. Of course, and Reggie, of course, and I said both on the board of Urban League for a long time. And he did a good job as far as letting these people know, you know, and how to do certain things. Because he was the only time. I tell you an experience that I had that was really something. I'm out on assignment, 6 months working, you know, in politics and so on. I come back in the plant, and my foreman came, my supervisor came and brought me to the office. I know what it was about. After I got in there, there was a fellow sitting there. And the foreman said, Herb, they want you to go up in personnel and introduce me to the man. And the fellow was FBI. And he told me who he was. I said, well, Herb, you've been out working for 6 months, whatever time it was at the time. Your association was with a man that we know, or we believe is communist. And you were closely with him. I said, what the man are you talking about? And they called the man's name. I said, well, what's wrong with work with him? You know? I said, I have no control over him. He was representing his union. This fellow was from the United Steelworkers. And he was black. And, of course, I'd known him over the years, of course, and he is militant and was militant. But I had nothing to do with that. That's just me with him, you know? And we're working together. Well, anyway, we get up in the office. And we're sitting around talking. He's going over a lot of things. I see you've been so on, so on, so on. And you were leading the Able Committee. What was that committee? What was it about? I told him. And in the meantime, Harry Winston, who at that time was industrial relations personnel man, he was sitting over there. And Harry said to me, so, Herb, so will you sometime get me one of the little cards that we identified the guys with? I said, sure, I'll be glad to. So we talked, and this guy is saying to me, he says, "You mean that the whites came down into the community where you lived and they participated in your meetings?" I said, "Yes." He says, "Well, now, we haven't been long in this conversation." And he says to me, he says, "Don't you know any time whites come into a black community that purpose?" So he was really trying to get me to, in my soul, to be communist. "Don't you know that there's some ulterior motives and that they are..." And by this time, Harris said, "Wait a minute." He says, "Wait a minute. Herb, you excuse." I said, "Well, I said, before I'm excused, I just want, there's something I want to know." He said, "What is it?" "I'm talking to the FBI man." And I said, "You know, now I've been harassed, my neighbors have been harassed for a long time. How long is this going to go on?" And this fellow says to me, he said, "Well, as long as you are active as you are, then I guess it will go on." And I never forget, I was leaving, and I said, "Well, you're going to have a permanent job."
Have you seen him recently?
I haven't seen him, but what happened, when Harry released me, I figured what he wanted to do. He wanted to really lay it down to this man, you know, how are you going to identify him or anybody with communism because whites are in a community working with people? That was the craziest thing I ever heard of, you know. And this guy, he said he wasn't well tutored, in my opinion. Of course, his whole attitude was of a bigoted nature.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I couldn't understand it. It was, these people are supposed to be educated to some extent. And I just could not get this kind of comparison. I said, "Well, I'll be doggone." It really made me a little teed. But I knew I had a job. And the other is, I don't anger easy, you know. And I thought I'd just leave it to his ignorance. And I figured what Harry was going to do. And I suspect it's what he did. I'm sure that's what he did, you know. Yeah.
But it sounds like you faced a fair amount of harassment.
Oh, well, yes, it went on for a long time. It was up until 1958 or somewhere around 58 or 60.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it was.
Well, what about, that brought to mind, to what extent was there cooperation with the Mexican community, with the, I don't know if there were any Asian workers, if there was anyone from the Chinese community, of course the Japanese were imprisoned, mm-hmm. Out at Lockheed. Was there any work with them too? Did the clause apply only? Did it exclude only blacks? Did it also
only
exclude Hispanics?
Only blacks.
And how about Asians?
Nope.
Oh.
Only blacks.
How interesting. Given the long history of anti-Asian,
but a competent white candidate. And you see, it hadn't been up until most recent years that the Mexican-American has been identified other than Caucasian, okay? And, of course, this was acceptable, even though they were treated lesser than. And, it wasn't until the civil rights movement really emerged,
mm-hmm.
and the whole bit. And so they found out, too, that by census, they were getting the short end of a lot of things.
Yes.
And, of course, they changed.
Because I noticed in our going through, unfortunately, the eagle for the period is nowhere to be found. But in going through, the sentinel, the eagle, in going through the eagle, periodically we've been coming across things that was an attempt to tie in with the Mexican workers as well as the black workers. But there was that. Was there any sort of combined effort at Lockheed among the workers?
That I don't recall there being a single Mexican party person involved in our efforts, no one. We didn't solicit,
mm-hmm.
but it was open for any employees.
Mm-hmm.
And now, as I said, later women got involved. And of course, the same thing, black women.
Mm-hmm.
They had the menial jobs. They were custodians,
mm-hmm.
and this kind of thing. And it wasn't until later that they moved into the area of, and there was a diary then, assembly workers and this kind of thing. And they went through intensive program training, extensive. But what happened, as I said, the women, well, they felt that they were being discriminated against, but they didn't fight as hard because they felt limited to, I guess, how would I put it, certain kind of jobs,
mm-hmm.
you know? And you see, women rights, as far as that go, wasn't thought of in terms of, man, I can do that job. I said, hey, you had a few women like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I can well remember some women. She had this 50-pound limit and all this other kind of stuff to keep women in a certain mm-hmm. job situation. But there were a few women who fought even that and could win it, and some of those women could live more than the men, you know. And the point was, that was a crazy law anyway, because the average person is going to pick up more than 50 pounds. You've got lifts and things like that, you know. Just to make sense. And that's just the way they tried to treat mm-hmm. blacks, you know. And this code identification thing.
Well, to the best of your recollection, what percentage of the women would you say were black by, say, 1943?
I really wouldn't know. I really wouldn't.
Do you think it was as high as 10%?
I wouldn't say. Mm-hmm. It could be somewhere between 7 and 10. Yeah.
Because it's just been so hard to get that information.
Yeah.
I know it seems that North Americans probably had the highest percentage of blacks overall, men and women.
Well,
I think of its location.
Well, not necessarily, no.
Oh, well, do you have...
Oh, yes. Oh. Well, you see, North American was UAW. And UAW was Walter Ruger.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that policy was no discrimination. That was their policy. And to the degree of hiring practices, I would say they enforced it pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
So for that reason, you found a larger number of minorities
mm-hmm.
and blacks, particularly in North America.
Mm-hmm.
It had not been for the blacks in Detroit, they never would have got the automobile industry.
Right.
So, and of course, Walter and other guys there certainly knew that. But even before Walter, that you had, I can't think of his name now, but you had him, of course, who was a liberal too, and you recognized
mm-hmm.
your central area of power, and of course that is what they did. And while it was small indeed, not that some other areas are maybe in fight so hard for, but at least it formed a
mm-hmm.
good job.
Well, did you have contact with the people eventually at Maywood and at the 7th and Santa Fe plant?
Oh, I had the 7th Santa Fe plant. Yes, I had contact with them. Maywood plant, I had contact with Maywood plants, of course, after the Maywood plant got to being.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lot of contact with Maywood plant. In fact, the Maywood plant was a party of our local. While they were located way out there, they would hold meetings, would be called rump meetings,
mm-hmm.
because they'd have to motor all the way to the valley, which was a long way. And for the most part, those people lived in that general area, or they lived, say, like close to Watts,
mm-hmm.
and this kind of thing. So, yes, I had contacts with them.
Do you have a sense that either of those places had a higher concentration of black workers than the Burbank plant?
No, I don't. I don't really know that.
Mm-hmm.
I know that I think there were more Mexican Americans working at the Maywood plant than would have been, say, like at, I would say the ratio would have been greater if you're going to make a comparison there, because they lived generally in the east
mm-hmm.
side, far east side of Los Angeles, and it's closer to them, where even in the valley, there's a large number of Mexican Americans. They were exposed to more and different types of jobs other than aircraft, you see. So they were spread out
mm-hmm.
Industrially.
Mm-hmm.
While those people didn't have too many industries located there.
Right.
So the concentration was
It's been hard for us to get a sense of where the minority workers represented a greater percentage because of the way they've hidden their figures. I mean, part of the problem is that obviously they're worried about affirmative action in the way these figures that we're trying to get might be used now, so it's been difficult to get some of this. During the fight within the union itself, were there groups, any sort of support groups elsewhere in the country of black workers with whom you were in touch, who were in the IAM, who were at least in touch with you and trying to do something within their own locals?
No. And the only association that I had with them later was at conferences and conventions. You see, in 1960, I guess it was 1960. No, it wasn't 1960. It was 1956. In 1956 in San Francisco, this question came up in the convention, and that was at that time. You had many blacks at Douglas, and many blacks at Lockheed. It came on the convention floor. And it was really going to be a Donnybrook. I took the mic. The people from Canada did many resolutions on this thing. And I took the mic. And in the interest of peace and what I thought we were trying to do, I asked that there'd be no further debate on it, and that there would be a vote on it, calling attention to the wrongness of it. And while we had been working in the interest of resolving this situation, calling attention to our group, that we felt that that time was close. We had certain promises made from A.J. Hayes, who at that time was the international president and a very well-respected person. Soften this whole thing, because what friends we had made, we did not want to engender any anger that might have messed up what we had planned. So it did spoil the thing, and the other guys didn't agree with me and told me vehemently they didn't. At that time, you had black locals in the South. These are black locals.
Segregated.
Uh-huh. And they were taking positions. They didn't want to see no changes. And they were the hardest people in the world to talk to. I tried to talk to some of them, some from Florida, some from Georgia, and some from Texas, but there wasn't very many from Texas. It wasn't Georgia, Florida, and where else? Some other southern places. I was trying to talk to them. They didn't want to hear me. You know, look, if we get integrated, we're not going to have black presidents. We're not going to have financial secretaries. We're not going to have this offices, you know. I said, you know, that's a very selfish attitude, and one that says to me that for whatever this kind of thing denotes in symbolism, you're willing to sacrifice all of everything that you can get for the betterment of the kind of thing we're fighting for generally throughout the United States. Integration, so that you can have all these advantages. It's a long-term thing. I says, but you see, it'll come. But in the interest of what you're enjoying now, you want to make this up. I did everything I could to try to shame him. Many of them, we don't want to do that. We had to force them to do it after we made the changes.
So it wasn't just the white segregated locals in the South?
No, it was not. It was some that were the blacks. Mm-hmm. They didn't want this to happen.
And now what about the local that you talked about, the auxiliary local up in Washington or Oregon, during all the fights?
I never contacted them. I know that they were there, but as I said, I never contacted any of those. And the biggest fights going on during that time, there were two in the labor movement, the Boilermakers mm-hmm. and the Machinists. Mm-hmm. And Walter, who was a schoolmate of mine, we graduated together, he was leading that fight there, and I was leading the fight in the Machinists. And of course, it was, as I said, the Boilermakers had these auxiliary units, and it was quite a fight. They had a thing going on really big, and of course we had a thing going on big too, we thought. And it was two of the black marks, really black marks, on the larger unions in AFL.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The support of these other people. So it sounds like it was basically just the committee here in Los Angeles with eventual support on more of an individual basis built elsewhere in the country as you would go mm-hmm. to the conventions, that sort of thing. But there wasn't a large movement that developed really around it. Mm-hmm. as the committee, you said initially when the committee was first formed, it was all men. As more and more black women did come into the shop,
mm-hmm.
did the women get involved in the committee as
yes,
well?
Yes, they did, but not in large numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Our meetings were held on Sunday afternoons, and many times, of course, women had other things to do, the housework, mm-hmm. the husbands, you know, and this kind of thing. But they did come, but they're not in numbers.
Mm-hmm.
They were there.
Primarily support rather than
right.
active
right.
leadership.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's quite a story.
Well, it's quite an experience.